Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 4th of March. Very nice to have you with us. I am glad you are here and hope you will continue to be. We count on it, actually. We like that. Panel at WAMC.org is how you can join us. It's as simple as that. Panel at WAMC.org. And we are, we welcome your letters. Keep them short. Keep them to the point. Simple as that. Panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we'll get started in our conversation for this Thursday morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. I'm happy. I'm well-employed, and I'm having a good time.
Excellent. All good to hear. Thank you. We go to Cohoes Director, City Director of Operations, Teresa Bourgeois. Why am I tripping over that? I apologize, Teresa. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Good to hear your voice. Thank you. Jim Henler is back, and we couldn't be more thrilled. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. Jim Henler, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. I'm glad to thrill you.
Yes. It doesn't take much. And counterterrorism expert, best-selling author, and man who throws us all for a loop, Malcolm Nance is with us. Good morning, Malcolm.
Good morning. I've got sunshine starting, so any day that has that is a good day.
Yeah, it is a good day. I agree with you. Well, let's start, and Malcolm, I'll probably throw this to you first because, there's concerns of what's happening at the Capitol. March 4th is a big day in the QAnon calendar, so that means that there are concerns about another Capitol attack. The Capitol Police were on guard for another assault on the Capitol building on Thursday after obtaining intelligence on a potential plot by a militia group, even as the Senate was poised to possibly begin debate on President Biden's $1.9 trillion economic stimulus plan. The new threat comes 2 months after supporters, of course, stormed the Capitol building as Congress met to certify the 2020 election results. Intelligence analysts have been tracking online chatter by some adherents of the pro-Trump conspiracy theory known as QAnon. Those adherents appear to have latched on to March 4th, the original inauguration date set in the Constitution as the day that Donald Trump would be restored to the presidency and renew his crusade against the country's enemies. So, Malcolm, I know you have told us that you monitor this chatter. So how seriously, obviously our law enforcement is taking this seriously, but how serious should we be taking this?
Today, I'm going to make a pretty easy prediction. If some individual crazy who still believes in this doesn't come out and do anything, nothing's going to happen today. And this is the interesting thing about the QAnon phenomena. They can change their crazy conspiracy theory on a dime. I mean, every time something happens, they will shift what they had just said the day before. Like Donald Trump, they have no problem in, bending reality and saying that they never said something. So this week in crazy QAnon world, and I use that term crazy as an intelligence professional because that is what it is. In the QAnon world, they are now claiming that the March 4th date that I saw for weeks after the Capitol attack was actually a false flag, a trick started by liberals to get QAnon people caught out in public, and that they believe anything that happens today is the actual liberal cabal that Donald Trump is fighting, making their own terrorist attacks on the United States. So they've completely walked away from the March 4th date and the March 20th date. And in their world, Donald Trump has never stopped being president of the United States. And he is still doing the plan, right? This long-range plan. This is what happens when you have a overwhelmingly large number of people with mental instability. And I hate to say it, I think they're emboldened by this because now they know they have QAnon members of Congress.
Alan?
Well, I'm angry. I agree with everything that has just been said. By Malcolm. But I have to say I'm angry that the Congress postponed their session today. Because what it did was to give in to these what words can we use on the radio? But they have given
nutcase.
Yes, but the Congress has given them credibility by saying we're not even going to meet because we're being threatened. Now the Senate is meeting,
right?
But the House of Representatives isn't, and I think that's a damn disgrace.
Jim Heller, you're about to say.
I was going to say, something very interesting this morning. So before the show, I was just checking all my favorite conspiracy sites, and almost all of them are down today, saying server crashes and things like that. So I think the communications have been disrupted in an interesting way, and whether that's happened by design or by some other interesting thing, we can really see that the online world is starting to have response to some of these things going on, so not just the in-person world.
So I apologize for being stupid. So what you're saying is that that many of these could be down because there is action being taken to put them down, correct?
It could certainly be that they're down because somebody has taken them down. I imagine our government has people who could do that. But it can also be simply that there was just a lot of traffic going on and that disrupted things. But it looks like most of these are server crashes and what's called denial of service attacks. So it can be self-inflicted or externally inflicted. But we certainly see very interesting things happening in cyberspace today.
That's interesting. I think that's a great thing. I think any offensive action that private citizens take, and I'm looking forward to see whether the Great Awakening website is still up this morning. But you know what? Neutralize this silliness now. And I know a lot of it's probably vigilanteism, but there's also the liability factor from companies that host their chat rooms.
So what does it mean when a spy says neutralize? What does that
Not
mean?
Not what you think.
Okay.
What it means is what we're seeing is to, the FBI can't do this. They'd have to have some legal basis.
Right.
But, I'm a friend of one of the most famous hackers in the world, the Jester. And there are a lot of cyber vigilantes out there who will take this issue on their own and make sure the Q has no mouthpiece today.
Q has no none. Teresa Bourgeois.
So two things. I agree with Alan. It's easy for me to say, sitting safely in my home, that Congress, the House, should have gone in today. But I really do think, even if it was a pro forma session, just some speeches or whatever, that they should have had some people there and not bow to this pressure, because I think it emboldens them. But I do wonder, Jim, Malcolm, do you know who is behind this? Who's funding QAnon? Who is funding this disinformation campaign?
Great question. Do we know that, Malcolm?
Yeah. Well, actually, in some instances we do. Look, with regards to the QAnon, this is a massive ball of crazy. They are self-funded, right? They are all these are, and it's so insidious because it started off with this apparent, online game of this individual 4 years ago, but it is snowballed into an industry. So people are selling QAnon t-shirts and QAnon flags and all this stuff. And it's becoming the base ideology of the Republican Party.
But do we know that it's not an orchestrated disinformation campaign?
So Teresa, what QAnon has done is it has pulled together many different crazies. And I mean crazy, they're both individuals, but crazy ideas, right? So you had, everything from the Flat Earth Society and the anti-evolutionists who suddenly got pulled into this political mass, as well as the people who believe in the Great Awakening, the Trumpies. I mean, it's really a kind of very interesting thing. We're doing some new research now at RPI trying to look at, can you find the spider in the center of these conspiracy webs? Using various kinds of network analytics and other language-based approaches. And it's very interesting because you do find hubs, but you don't find the kind of central entity you'd want. What you see is almost like a web of webs. And it's, you know, it's very insidious because there isn't a head you can cut off. There isn't a place you can say, this is where the bad stuff is coming from. Let's, you know, let's try to show that that's not credible. And so it really is a very, it's a very interesting phenomenon from a scientific point of view, but it's very scary.
It does concern me that it seems like it was a group of far outliers who have been almost in an orchestrated way pulled together and made somewhat stronger and given fuel. And what I wonder and worry about is this being orchestrated in some way as a concentrated disinformation campaign?
I think what we do see, and Jim, that was a great description. I'm glad RPI is doing work on this. I hope everyone who's in the computer science industry takes some look at this. Because what you've seen is what would have been seen in the 1960s by like the John Birch Society or the Lyndon LaRouche people, if those of you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Remember how they had to sit in the airport and hand you a pamphlet? And you would go, that's crazy. And you throw it right into the trash can. Or the John Birchers would send you a mimeograph in the mail. Well, those crazy ideologies have become an umbrella ideology for all of the most mainstream conservative insane beliefs. But it is now moving at the speed of the electron. And it doesn't require a centralized hub to about disinformation. The hub itself, I mean, all recipients themselves will re-spread this information. And Q people call it red pilling, right? But the beautiful part of this is they've taken American conservatism and turned Donald Trump into the hero of this story where he takes on anti-vax, or he takes on vaccines, he takes on Black people and Indians and child molesters and brings it all together into this insane hero's journey where this overweight, lying ex-billionaire is the global hero of saving American society. The problem is the final solution, literally, is the elimination of liberals in America through genocide. And that's what they look forward to, the day of the storm. So how do you control this narrative that you could join right now and contribute to the expansion of that narrative with your own crazy input?
Well, and then the other thing to understand about this, and part of what makes it so dangerous, is, again, it's that web of webs thing. So the white supremacists, right, were not politically tied to anything before. Now, through these connections, through this kind of overarching conspiracy, you get something growing in that space, and suddenly it's pulled together with some other group that, you know, again, the Trumpies or the take over the Congress group, or, you know, pick your favorite. So you suddenly have sort of these small pods, call it, of crazy that are suddenly become central to this larger thing, and therefore that ideology. So the people who originally weren't out to kill the liberals, they were only out to kill the Jews and the Blacks, are suddenly, you know, part of a mainstream political conspiracy. It's a very strange world out there when you look at this stuff.
And I guess as an uninformed but concerned person, I wonder is, as the Trump narrative got woven into this story and these groups get woven closer and closer together, is that happening organically, or is that happening in an orchestrated way?
Both.
Yeah. I think it initially started because the character of Q, who uses this, by the way, it's named after supposedly a Q security clearance, which is a top secret security clearance at the Department of Energy. Okay?
Yep.
I rode nuclear submarines. I had Q clearance. That was one of the lowest clearances I had. But, you know,
yeah,
when you're
too
telling a fantasy.
Still sounds cool.
Yeah.
Right? I'm impressed.
Right? So, you know, it was a dot on my badge. So when you're telling this crazy conspiracy story and saying we're a group of patriot intelligence officers that are here to defend America and Donald Trump is the hero, they glommed on to the conspiratorial theory nature of Republican conservatism in America and then expanded it to where every other ill in the world is being served by the liberals, the Jews, including blood libel against the Jews, and everything, to where every conspiracy theory from aliens and Area 51 are all part of this narrative. But this conservative movement made Trump the hero of this story. And the problem is it's running into reality.
Alan, we got about a minute. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I wanted to say is, look, this is, and I'm sure Malcolm will agree, this is not brand new. You saw the coalescence around Ronald Reagan, for example. You know, many of these same people were there to do that. He was popular because he spoke well. He, Death Valley days and all of the rest of that. Nevertheless, he was of that ilk. Malcolm?
Malcolm?
That Ronald Reagan was of that ilk?
Ronald Reagan was an extreme conservative, and the people who were surrounded him were certainly there.
Yes, but look at let's juxtapose it with the reality of what we have today.
We just have about 30 seconds, so we can come back on the other side.
Now we have 10.
Were mainly people who were veterans of World War II, so they had a better grounding in reality. This what we're seeing now is if the John Birch Society had elected a president of the United States.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation. We have letters as well. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, and Malcolm Nance making up the panel this morning. We would love to hear from you, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, and Malcolm Nance. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Joan asks, how is it possible that the identity of QAnon remains unknown? We sort of touched on this, but anybody want to get to how it remains in the shadows?
Well, because the person who originated the story is just not giving it up. Vice TV did a very good investigation called The Search for Q, and they've got it down to two individuals, one of whom ran one of the channels. But then again, there was another woman who had created a pro-Trump conservative group who has convinced herself that she was QAnon, to the point where she was in a video with Donald Trump shouting at him, I'm Q, we're Q, we did this for you. And it may be the juxtaposition of two separate games, one individual who actually started it and other individuals who amplified it and took control of it or are still in there doing the amplification of that. But, you know, a lot of people have figured out how to make money from this. And that's why I think it has some persistence.
Well, and then the other thing is it's kind of like a hydra. You cut off one head and three more grow out because it doesn't require anymore that there's a single central. But so, for example, if I go on five or six of the different websites where a lot of this stuff is happening, I'm not even talking about like the ones where you have to be a deep, deep insider to get access. There's ones anybody can look at. But you see different hubs of these things. So they're very disconnected. And, you know, there's now QAnon UK, QAnon Australia. I mean, just about anywhere in the English-speaking world, there is now parts starting to spread. So it really no longer is likely to have just a single person who's keeping it alive. It's lots and lots of sort of dedicated volunteers, as it were.
I want to get back to an aspect, Alan, that you started off with that I think is something I don't want to skip over, and that is the fact that the House suspended session today. And that struck me as odd, too, because they were so hell-bent after the January 6th riot to do the business of the people and to go in and to count the votes. And this that's as the Capitol was an active crime scene, and they were still counting the dead. So what do you think went into the decision? And especially, and I guess this also goes to Malcolm, but especially given that the Capitol is so difficult now to even look at.
Well, I am going to defer to Malcolm, but here's what I suspect. There are a couple of congresspeople who were who are part of them, and that's a difficult thing, and I think they may be having some trouble controlling all of that. Nevertheless, they did the right thing, right, Malcolm? They went back that night on January 6th, and they passed they confirmed the election, and they did what they had to do. To give solace to these people now and to say, we're so scared of you that we're going to close down the Congress for a day, that is just plain stupid.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that. I would have had a giant cookout on the West Portico of the Capitol.
A buffet.
I would have invited
early
all
Easter
the
egg roll.
The National Guard. There are still 10,000 National Guard there. And if you haven't seen the Capitol recently, I was there a couple of days after the 6th. Literally every 10 feet. I am not joking. Look to your left 10 feet. Look to your right 10 feet. There is an armed National Guardsman around the entire 19-block perimeter of the Capitol. It is not a joke there. And so no one's going to do anything today. But can I make a quick aside? I was just on the one of the QAnon forums, and the one of the major ones, the public ones, and they are now officially saying that Q warned them on November 15th, 2019, that March 4th is a trap. And the bizarre numerology way that they got that is just nuts. And so here it is, Q has told us March 4th is a trap. Therefore, if anything happens, it's not us. crazy.
Jim?
Yep. So I'm going to disagree a little bit with you, Alan. I think in some ways today's threat was in some ways scarier, right? Because what the real intelligence warnings are now and the real fear is, as Malcolm says, some individual crazy. And it's not necessarily going to be an attack on the Capitol. It could be some staff member who shot on the metro on their way in or something. So I think, there's a certain amount of taking these things seriously that we weren't doing before. All of the investigation into January 6th is around the fact that no one really believed these things people were saying about coming and doing this stuff.
Yes,
now,
but we
again,
certainly
it was different. But I was going to say, it's not just, the people in the room at Congress. It's all of their staffs, all of the things that support them, all of the interns and things, So those people are now staying home today, and maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, well, why don't we keep everybody in New York City home, everybody in Washington, D.C. home? Look, I understand what you're saying, you can't give in to these people, and we don't. We don't close down the subways because there may be one nut on the subway. And even though we're gonna have to suffer with that, I don't think that's a rationale for closing down the Congress, the People's House of the United States. I just feel very strongly about that.
Teresa?
Yeah, I think that I agree. There's probably something that we don't know that they saw that was particularly alarming. But you could have a session without having a full session. There is a middle ground here where you don't put everybody at risk, but there are some people there, and you don't give them the, what appears to be a, I don't want to call it a win, but embolden them. And I do, but this, I have not heard all of the testimony. I've not heard a lot of the testimony of these hearings about what happened on the 6th, but boy, it is so disturbing and requires absolutely has to be an independent commission to look into what happened. But, Alan, I agree. I think that they should have stayed open in some way so that you can send most people home but still have an ongoing session without votes. As long as you don't have votes, you can have a lot fewer people there.
This is from Greg, who has a question for Malcolm. On Tuesday, you spoke on MSNBC about using, quote, gene fencing to find people who were involved in the January 6th riot. Can you please give details on gene fencing? Well, bring us up to date on that, Malcolm.
Yeah, he's in error of the words that I use. It's called GEO, G-E-O, fencing. Geographic.
Oh, well, that makes more sense.
And
I thought you were splicing genes or something down there in Hudson. I didn't know what the hell you were doing.
Oh, okay. I wish I could splice genes. But
no, come talk to
geofencing
us.
Geofencing is where
Jim knows a guy.
Capitol Hill has its own radio and cellular repeaters to facilitate communications in that neighborhood. You know, especially around the complex. It's not one place. It's 19 buildings. And the FBI, working with the telecommunications companies, can tell you precisely every phone that was inside that building.
Right.
And that geofence has already been used in, you know, we've seen hints of it in some indictments. So a fascinating little tool, but it's, you know, if you had your phone on and you were in that building, it's going to be one of the pieces of evidence that they will use against you.
How long does that all take? I mean, we have all these cool tools. How long does it take?
Well, you know, this is under investigatory technique. So it'll take more than 5 minutes. It's not like in CSI, right? But you can be sure someone's on it. Because, you know, they've indicted and arrested 250 people already, and they're looking at 1,000 or more. So every one of those people, you have to cross-reference against their phone number, the, you know, were they included in any calls with other people who may have been part of a conspiracy? Did they call any congressmen during the attack? I mean, there's things that are yet to be found out but are very important. Can I make a quick comment?
Yes, and then we're going to take a break, but go ahead.
I was just on the Crazy Q site. And one person referred to the Biden election as a color revolution. And I find this fascinating because Jim was talking a little earlier about, you know, where is the spider inside this web? The phrase color revolution meant the revolutions in the former Soviet Union against Russia of the 2000s. And Vladimir Putin has been warning America would have a color revolution against Donald Trump. And I find it fascinating that these Q people are using Russian propaganda terms, you know, and it just shows you that there is foreign influence in there, even in some of the more, you know, I'm sure it comes from Russia Today television channel, which they watch incessantly. So there you have it.
Scary stuff. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We'll talk about what the Senate will be working on today, which is the $1.9 trillion relief bill. We'll talk about that and much more. We welcome your letters. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, and Malcolm Nance join us. You can too. Panel at WAMC.org. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. So the news yesterday coming out of the discussions over the stimulus package is that the president limited eligibility for stimulus payments under pressure from moderate Senate Democrats. The change comes as the Senate prepares to move forward on the President Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill. You will recall yesterday we were talking about Chuck Schumer saying we have the votes. So under the new structure, the relief checks would phase out faster for those at higher income levels compared with the way the direct payments were structured in Biden's initial proposal and the version of the bill passed by the House on Saturday. The change came as the Senate prepared to take an initial procedural vote to move forward on the bill as early as today. Biden and Senate Democratic leaders were scrambling to keep their caucus united since they cannot lose a single Democrat in the 50-50 Senate if Republicans unite against the legislation. Alan.
Well, you know, I had my doubts yesterday when we, you know, when we said Biden said he had the votes or Schumer said he had the votes, because these people are egotists and, if they think that if a couple of them like Manchin and others can make a difference before their constituency, that they're standing up to everybody else, it actually helps them. From a political point of view, so you can't really count until the absolute last minute as to whether or not you have those votes. If somebody thinks that their political career is going down the tubes, if they don't make the right sounds, that could be very instructive as to what they're going to do.
Teresa.
Well, I do think that they're tinkering at the margins so that they can both shore up the Democrats and Manchin in particular and Jean Shaheen and others and possibly get one Republican, Murkowski. And I think that some of the things that they're talking about, like tighter targeting of the stimulus checks, I don't think there's going to be a lot of pushback on that, is that the calculation is about 12 million fewer people, adults, will get the checks, but these are people in the $200,000 annual income range. The question is, if they make too many significant changes, will there be a problem getting it through the House? And it needs to be done by March 14th. That's the key. It has to be done by March 14th because that's when the unemployment benefits expire. And we can't lose sight of the fact that both Republicans and Democrats around the country, even though Republicans in the Senate don't support this, it's widely supported by Republicans and Democrats around the country.
So shouldn't somebody who makes $200,000 get this check, Teresa?
Pardon?
Should somebody who makes $200,000 a year be getting this relief check? See, I mean, I think Biden is a very moderate guy, and he wants support of the moderates because he believes it's right. But I think that those who are arguing for a more moderated program are absolutely correct.
And I think that will be approved. Right. I think that this targeting, now whether or not, you know, there's also a discussion about should the weekly unemployment benefit go from $400 a week to $300 a week. I'm not an economist. I don't know what kind of change that creates. But apparently they're going to hold firm on the $400. Manchin wants $300. But I think there's probably public support you know, right now it'll be individuals earning $75,000 per year. Couples making up to $150,000 per year will qualify for the full $1,400 payment, and then it scales down up to where couples making $200,000 or above will not get a payment. There's probably public support for that.
Jim?
So I had a question. You know, one of the things that's all over the news today is that the Republicans are going to make them read every word in the bill and other things, all sorts of delaying tactics that seem like they don't have any real impact. Do you think that's because they're grandstanding, or is that, Alan, maybe what you were saying, that, you know, they're hoping the extra time will cause somebody to flip a vote or something?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it tactical or is it just, you know, media?
It's always tactical.
Right.
It's always tactical. They're trying to figure out who they lose, who they gain by doing it. But it's interesting that you get nothing, and I mean nothing, from the Republicans. Nothing. And why I'm interested in is, you know, huge numbers of Republicans support Trump no matter what. We know that. On the other hand, 70-80% of the American people support this program, the Biden bailout. So you know, you got the Trump hold on the Republicans, who know their constituents want the program, and you can't, and they lose no one because they know, those people know they're out of there if they do it.
But Jim, you know, it's a 650-page bill. The only difference it makes is, rather than passing it on Friday, they'll pass it over the weekend, right? It'll just slow it down for a couple of days because they can read pretty fast. But I also think it'll draw more attention to the fact that the bill's on the floor. And the one of the things that Biden's team has been very effective at is building public support among Republican mayors around the country and local Republican government officials and some Republican governors. And, you know, this has a lot of support. Not every part of it has a lot of support, but it does have a lot of support around the country.
Malcolm?
Oh, I'm passing to Alan for this segment.
Okay.
Thank you. And back to you, Malcolm.
He passed to you earlier, so that certainly makes sense. That's fine.
All I know is I'm now, even though I'm a widower, I'm considered a single filer this year, and I am not getting a stimulus check. But I am interested in the way that Manchin is allowed to run the United States Senate now, and I think he enjoys that. He is essentially becoming the master of the Senate. And I'm wondering why Biden hasn't worked very carefully, along with Chuck Schumer, to get a Republican to defect to the Democratic Party, neutralize that.
It's a tough one. You know what happens, Malcolm, is when somebody defects, the people who they're coming to, the Democrats, say, hey, he was a Republican, we don't like him, we're not going to reelect him, we're not going to put him back there. And the people who he defected from hate him too. So it's a very tricky thing to get them to do that. I've seen it happen before. I remember once, I think the guy's name was Michaels, in the New York State Assembly, he was the crucial vote on abortion. He was for a woman's right to an abortion. He stood up. He was from upstate New York. He stood up and he said, you know, my kid called me a dirty name, and I think he's right. And he cried and he said, I didn't know this is the end of my career. And it was.
Well, I think that the concern is if Manchin would go the other way, which he says he won't. Yeah. But I think the key is to keep working to try to get some of the moderate Republicans to be on board with some of these. And I know it's a tough sell, but
tough enough so that there's no tough enough, right, Teresa, so that there's no indication anybody's falling for it.
Yep. Well, Murkowski has said a couple of times in the last few days that her constituents really need this support, and she's considering it. One of her concerns was the targeting of the checks. Who knows if that's going to be enough to pull her over to vote for it. But she's very, very independent in Alaska and has proved that works for her politically. So we shall see. But I'm more interested in the Republicans are so loudly against raising the minimum wage. Now, I'm one that believes it should not be on this bill. It should be done separately and can be. But I think that the Democrats should say to the Republicans, okay, you don't want all of these supports. You don't want increased food supports. You don't want increased wage supports, whatever. So then how are people going to live? And wouldn't it be if they were paid a livable wage, right? One of the ways to reduce the amount of government supports is if people get paid a livable wage, because, in fact, these government supports are subsidizing these companies who don't pay their people a livable wage. And so how can you say we don't want these federal supports for food, housing, whatever, yet we don't agree that people should be paid a livable wage? I think that's a serious problem for the Republicans.
Anybody else on that? All right. Let's go to some letters that we have here. We go to a lot of these are on what we were talking about earlier about the Capitol. So Mark said, did I hear General Walker say yesterday in response to a question that he would have been able to respond more quickly to the violence plan for the Stop the Steal protest without the order on January 4th from the Secretary of Defense creating additional and unique restrictions on deployment of the D.C. National Guard? The 3-plus-hour delay in approval came from senior DOD staff. The Trump administration removed several senior defense officials and appointed loyalists after the election. Somewhere in there is a question. Malcolm, would you care to answer it?
Yeah, I heard it. Yeah, the question is correct. General Walker did testify to that. He said that he had people at the National Guard Armory. They were loaded on buses and could have been at the Capitol in 18 minutes. But being a military officer, he had to go by his chain of command. Even though they were having emergency frantic calls into the Capitol, the acting Secretary of Defense, Chris Miller, who was a low-levels ex-Special Forces colonel that was at the Counterterrorism Center and was promoted above hundreds of people to be the Secretary of Defense, specifically gave the Washington, D.C. National Guard orders that they were not to do anything on the 6th without his personal permission. So instead of responding within 18 minutes of the start of this insurrection, they sat on buses for 3 hours before the Secretary of Defense gave them permission. Look, I'm going to tell you guys something. As an intelligence person and been around the defense world, we have television on everywhere at all the watch officers' desks. The Secretary of Defense has it on all three channels in his room. They were all watching this insurrection. That man, I believe that person is the key node in this story. Either he was operating under orders not to intervene, or he chose for Defense Department not to intervene and to allow this to happen. I think the rest of it were just people who slacked at their duties. But that guy, it appears, Chris Miller, did this deliberately.
Who else has a cuckoo clock? Yeah, I thought Rosemary only had
a
cuckoo.
Sorry, that's mine.
Why isn't that
just trying,
when I
trying to keep the cuckoo thing going here?
Thought the timing was it was wonderful.
Yeah.
Exquisite timing.
As the cuckoo tells us, it's 10 o'clock, so it's time for news with Ray Graff. I'll stop extrapolating from there, and we'll go to that. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us in our second hour here. We welcome you. Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Hendler, and Malcolm Nance make up the panel. So we have some letters about what we were talking about just before the break on the relief package and minimum wage. We'll go to those and then we'll move on to another topic. So Marty says, to piggyback off Teresa's comments about GOP opposition to COVID relief and raising the minimum wage, they don't care if people live. They spent the last 10 years trying to take away health care from millions of people. The GOP only cares about money, and the Democrats should stop negotiating with them because it is a fool's endeavor. Susan says, what will become of raising the minimum wage to $15? When will that ever come?
It'll just be done on a different bill like they did in, we did in 1996, and it was done again in 2000, was it 7 or 8? They just attach it to a different bill. The last time it was attached to a defense authorization bill and got overwhelming majority of votes.
Let's see. This is an answer for Alan from Michael. I have an answer for Alan regarding should people over $200,000 get a relief check? Yes. One, it's good politics to give people money. If you must, take it back during tax season when people report their incomes. Two, we've dispelled the notion that the federal government can't afford to do this. The uncomfortable question then becomes why. Three, Biden is on record saying the risk is not going to go is going big enough with the bill. Why restrict benefits to appease Joe Manchin? Jam that guy up.
Well, I wrote back on the $200,000. And I wrote what I thought was a really good comment. I wrote, nah.
All right.
Well, one of the questions that Senator Manchin and others are asking is, would it be better targeted if it was the money was in an infrastructure bill, for example, and which would then create jobs and deal with a lot of the infrastructure issues that we have all over the country? And in theory, yes. And I know President Biden has meetings today on an infrastructure bill. But the question is, are the Republicans going to block an infrastructure bill or allow for it to go through? So in theory, sure. But are we going to, I mean, we need an infrastructure bill because it will create jobs and it will address a lot of the long-term problems that have been neglected because the Congress has not come to agreement on an infrastructure package. But are the Republicans going to be naysayers on that also?
So are you putting this as a sort of either or, the infrastructure bill or the direct payments? Because I'll tell you right now, people understand the infrastructure, but they don't understand it the way they do, $1,400 or something like that in their pockets.
No, Alan, I was talking about the more tightly targeted payments. Bring it from 200,000 to 150,000 cap for couples. What some people are saying is just tighten up some of the portions of the package. Like, you absolutely have the direct payments, but you reduce the cap on who they go to. And I'm not an economist. I don't know where the threshold is, but the argument is take that savings. Now, some of them are saying don't fund state and local governments, and I would say that's a disaster from the perspective of a person who works in local government because of the incredible economic hit that local governments have taken. But I think it's not a question of yes or no on the stimulus checks. It's a question of what's the threshold.
All right.
You know, you're brilliant. You're brilliant at this, Teresa. But you know, I don't think it takes an economist. I think it takes a psychologist to figure what's primary in people's minds, and getting that money, I think, directly in a check is probably more important than anything else you could name. I'm sure you're right about everything you've said.
All right, let's go to two more letters. Nancy says, there's no reason to target relief checks. Universal programs are the most popular. Targeting slows down the process, increases the likelihood of excluding people who have lost their incomes, and they can claw back overpayments in future tax filings. More people will have gotten a relief check from Donald Trump than from Joe Biden. And then there's Madeline. Correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't these stimulus funds based on 2019 tax returns? It's hard to pass judgment on whether a couple earning $160,000 in 2019 still deserves a check, as nearly everyone has seen dramatic changes to their personal finances and or employment status in the last year. Betsy says, so if a single parent with two college-age kids who makes $80,000 won't get anything, how is it going to help Democrats? Just compare it to Trump's plan, which gave more people money. This makes no sense. What is good or moderate about it? The middle class gets screwed again.
No, they will get something because they have two kids and it would be graduated. Again, I'm not defending the scale back, but they would, a single person, two kids would get something.
I think this should be a regular feature on our program. Keith is writing to us, and in the subject line it says, Ask Malcolm. So I think we should just have that as a regular feature. The Ask Malcolm segment. So, Malcolm, Keith would like to know, has Citizens United supported and helped to incite the insanity we are witnessing in today's politics?
Oh, that's better, Alan. Question, and only in the sense that it allowed unlimited quantities of money to flow to the Republican Party, and it also helped fund all of the initiatives that dismantled the Voting Rights Act, which allowed them to cheat in elections for the Republican Party. So, in essence, yes, it got us straight directly to Donald Trump.
Now let's ask Alan.
I defer to Teresa.
Teresa, the effect?
Citizens United?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm passing the ball to Jim. No,
We can just move on. That's
fascinated by, I'm fascinated by the disinformation campaign and the social media and who fuels that and how it's funded, and I wish I better understood it. I'm fascinated, as I've talked before, about the Mercers and what they did with Cambridge Analytica and micro-targeting, and then followed that up by being the lead funder of Parler, and, you know, what's driving that and how that has a group like Parler brought together a lot of these groups. I think we need to understand what the money is behind this, these efforts to pull these groups together and fuel this movement.
An auxiliary point here. And that is that we do know that the Republican legislatures are really doing everything in their power to disenfranchise voters, right, everybody? That's the case. So the Congress, so the House of Representatives, barely controlled by the Democrats, and they better do it now or they're not going to get it done, and puts out a bill that will basically say, you can't cut that garbage out, you can't do that anymore, we're not going to let you do it. The Senate will not go along with it. And so the voters will be suppressed. No ends or buts about it.
Jim?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, I think the question being asked was might be whether Citizen United has had a real impact on the conspiracy theory stuff. And I think the answer is, well, it's had a huge political impact and these feed off of each other. There's not a lot of evidence that the conspiracy theory stuff is funded in any way that sort of that kind of central political speech thing that would have been the center of Citizens United. There may be other aspects, but I don't think that one had a huge impact.
All right.
Can I
build
on what Alan said? Because, Alan, I think that what you said is so critically, critically important to our democracy. I think what's going on right now in an underreported way at the state level that will structurally suppress the vote is deeply, deeply troubling to our democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think the House, with the passing the voting bill yesterday, H.R. 1, gets at that, but will it get passed through the Senate? I don't know. But I think that much more attention needs to be paid to this systematic effort at the state level run by Republicans to suppress the vote. And if people can only win by blocking people from voting, their constituents from voting, they should really, you know, look at themselves in the mirror. But if that's their strategy, it's a really troubling one for democracy.
That is their strategy. No two ways about it. We know what they're doing.
And I think you're right to raise that. This voting issue, voter suppression issue, in a methodical, systematic way that the Republican Party is engaged in right now all around the country, is a very serious problem for our democracy.
Brian says any discussion about the minimum wage is a moot point because of the unemployment benefits that are in place. The true minimum wage is right around $27 an hour. The idiots in Washington are killing us. That is anyone who is trying to run a small business.
Well, we certainly have had that discussion on this air. No question, you know, everybody wants the minimum wage, and yet there are bona fide people who will not be able to do business. Now, you know, you pay your money and you take your choice.
Kathleen says, why is Joe Manchin opposed to raising the minimum wage and extending full unemployment? I would imagine that his constituents in West Virginia could really benefit. What political sense does it make for him?
Anyone else want to go first?
Anyone on the motivation there?
Yeah, I don't know that Joe Manchin, Senator Manchin, is opposed to raising the minimum wage. Republicans are opposed to raising the minimum wage.
And it's a Trump state, right, Teresa? So therefore, he's scared of losing his office. It's that simple. And he puts his hand up in the air, and he sees which way the wind is blowing, and that's what he does.
All right, let's see. Let's go. Yes, let's go to new topic here, and that is a rather extraordinary day here in Albany, New York, yesterday, as the governor of New York State, in his first public appearance since a series of harassment allegations surfaced, said that he had learned an important lesson, however, said he refuses to resign over the matter. It was the first remark since a sexual harassment scandal enveloped his administration. Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Wednesday that he was embarrassed by his actions and apologized, but that he would not resign from office. The governor sought to quell the outrage over his actions regarding three young women, including accusations of sexual harassment from two former aides and another of unwanted touching and kissing at a wedding, as a growing chorus of his fellow Democrats called for him to step aside. Mr. Cuomo, his voice appearing to crack at times, said that he wanted New Yorkers to hear from me directly on this. I now understand that I acted in a way that made people feel uncomfortable, Mr. Cuomo said during an appearance at the state capitol. It was unintentional, and I truly and deeply apologize for it. I feel awful about it, and frankly, I'm embarrassed by it. And that's not easy to say, but that's the truth. Alan, a lot of people took the governor to task for his Sunday remarks and for the what many thought was a half apology or a faux apology. So what do you think, how do you think it went yesterday and what it means for the governor's future?
Well, as the majority leader of the New York State Senate, Ms. Cousins, said, it was a first step. And that, I think, considering the fact that she and Hastie, the speaker, are after Cuomo, maybe for past political transgressions. Although Jesse McKinley and I talked about that this morning on this. He's the New York Times guy. He doesn't think so. I think so. I think the fact is, as I have said too many times during this conversation, when you try to kill the king, you better succeed. And I see her stepping back, taking a step back. I suspect, knowing a little about Andrew Cuomo, he doesn't forgive or forget. He did what it was expected of him. He had to do. But his numbers are slipping terribly, and he's going to have to work all of that out, whether he thinks he can come back. I suspect he thinks he can, and he will, and he will run again.
Jim Hendler.
I tend to defer to Alan on this one when it comes to the governor. I have very mixed feelings on the whole thing. Partly because, on the national stage, when you had the Al Frankel thing and how that played out with the Republicans, hunkering down and the Democrats doing the right thing.
Al Franken?
Led to terrible political things. And, you have the same Republicans who were defending Donald Trump, who was accused of rape by how many women, are sitting here saying, oh, look, Cuomo. So... Right. I do think the investigation should go through. I think we should see what it says. Then make informed decisions. So at this point, I'm in a wait and see mode. I'm not going to jump to any conclusion either way.
You probably should be building a lot of prisons right now. If this becomes against the law, if men kiss women, quote, inappropriately or aggressive about it, you should probably build a lot of prisons. We have a cultural thing here, which is you really shouldn't do it if you think it through. It's that simple. But
Teresa?
Well, Alan, a couple things. On that, Alan, I think that there have been three different allegations, one of them having to do with kissing. So, and I think that the women absolutely should be heard. I think that it's essential that these situations be investigated. I do think that there needs, there is now a credible investigation underway. It's going to take time. We need to let that process work. So I think that, rather than calling for the governor to resign, we should let that process work. I do think, in your opening comments, the governor has cultivated the tough guy image, that persona, right? That's something that he's cultivated for a long, long time. And, that's not news. The question is, how does that affect public policy? How does that affect how people around him operate in fear, or some emulate his behavior? How does that affect his relationships with his counterparts, his colleagues, which is what you're alluding to with the leadership focus, on him? But I think you have to separate their reaction from his interaction with these three women, which does need to be investigated.
Well,
but I also
right.
think Jim Hendler's correct, and, this is a whataboutism alert, but I think that people, Democrats and Republicans, who didn't condemn Donald Trump for his behavior, Access Hollywood tape, the dozens of women who came forward with accusations of harassment and so much more, they have no standing in this conversation. And I think that's a real problem. And, Congressman Elise Stefanik talking to you here and others, that's a real serious problem that we have to get a hold of. And I think the bigger picture is, in all of this, we're losing the debate on the kind of things that, I'm not suggesting that this debate isn't important, but I just wish these guys would just behave themselves so we could get on to the real issues, which is our, deep fiscal problems, the minimum wage issues, the underlying issues about nursing homes. That's what we should be debating. But sorry, Alan, I interrupted you.
No, I interrupted you. But let's just assume, first of all, I agree with almost all of what you just said. And I've spent a lot of time around the New York State Legislature, and you've spent a lot of time in Washington and around the legislature. So we do know that this is what happens. People do this. But under no circumstances does that excuse it. It doesn't. Everybody has to think about what's going on and what they're doing. The idea that state legislators are calling out Cuomo for misbehavior is really pretty funny based on what I saw going on up there. And that was a while ago, I admit. But I don't think human nature has changed that much.
Right. I mean, I think the question is, in the workplace, where is the line? Did he cross it? That's why you have an investigation. Yeah. But it's important that all sides be heard, and it seems like there's a process in place with the Attorney General's office that's going to be looked into. But
she, of course, has a problem, right, in that a lot of people expect that she is setting herself up for a run for governor, Letitia James. So that automatically makes a and, of course, Cuomo did the same thing to Patterson. And to Spitzer. You know, you can't discount any of the political motivation in all of this, too, and payback from the leaders of the legislature who have felt oppressed for years by what they considered the, and I gave him this nickname a long time ago. I hope everybody remembers that, Tough Guy Andrew.
Okay, it's time. Go ahead.
But, Alan, even with all of the politics that's swirling around this, we can't lose sight of, was the behavior inappropriate or not? And that needs to be investigated.
He said it was. Yeah. So I think you're right about that.
Malcolm, your turn. Let's ask Malcolm. What do you think?
The only thing I have to say about this subject is, when he made his statement, I was very, very disappointed that he used the word embarrassed instead of shamed. Mm. And embarrassed meant I got caught.
Yeah.
Right.
And shame meant I feel extremely sorry for what I did. Right. And it was a big distinction for me because, you know, I liked Cuomo. I liked him during the whole coronavirus thing. He is a guy from a different era, whatever excuse he wants to use. But you know what? There's a big difference between you're embarrassed and you are feel shame. And I don't know if he actually feels shame.
That's a great point. Yeah. And it's hard because... And as Alan said, I mean, you know, people are saying this is a first step, but it also comes almost a week after the initial allegations. I mean, it took a long time to get there, right? And this is the statement that he gave on Wednesday after a statement that he gave on Sunday. So that's the other part of this, too. It's taken a long time for that to be delivered to the people.
Julie must be
Alan, call him up and ask him.
Yeah, there must be a lot of them. He doesn't take my calls, by the way. You all may remember that for 8 years he didn't talk to me, and then finally, you know, he did for a little while, and then he stopped on that too. And he always makes the point that I'm his political nemesis, that I always say things that about him that are cruel. You know, that's who the guy is. Malcolm, I wish I could call him up and say, okay, so what's happened here? And Ian and I have been sitting on Spilka's pins and needles, wondering if they'll ever call up and say, we'd like to talk to Shartok again, because you know what I'm going to ask him.
Yeah.
So
perhaps he needs you now.
But on the other hand, if he needs me, he can't make mistakes with me. He made two gigantic mistakes on those programs with me. One, when he said he was bringing his mother up, was it Christmas or Thanksgiving, which was he had said nobody should do, and that became worldwide interesting. And the other was when he used the N-word on the radio, describing what Italian Americans went through when they were coming up, and that made international headlines also. So these were perfectly innocuous questions. They were not important questions, but he made big mistakes, and you know who he felt was responsible for what happened to him, me.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go into our final round, and we'll have new topics. We have letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org, if you would like to share yours. Panel@WAMC.org. We have Alan Chartok, Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, and Malcolm Nance on the program this morning. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have about 15 minutes, and I would like to try to get as many topics in as we can in that time. Moving on to the tech world, and Jim, I'm sure you'll be hopefully will be up for this question, and that is Facebook ending their ban on political advertising. The social network has had prohibited political ads on its site indefinitely after the November election. Such ads have been criticized for spreading misinformation. So then on Wednesday, it planned to lift the ban on political advertising across its network, resuming a form of digital promotion that has been criticized for spreading misinformation and falsehoods and inflaming voters. Given that there is no such thing anymore as a political season because we're in it constantly, what do you think this means, Jim? And what would lead to a decision by Facebook to do this?
So what would lead to a decision by Facebook to do this? Greed.
Mm. Also, that old chestnut.
Well, I mean, you know, so it was interesting. I had a political site. Every day I got a thing from Facebook saying, you know, $10 and we'll promote your site to this many more people. So one day I decided to do it and my ad was turned down. And I had to go through 22 steps to try to prove I was really me and do all these things. And in the end, they turned it down anyway as being political. This was before they were banning political ads. Meanwhile, my page was showing up with all these ads from the big political parties on it, mostly from the other side of the political spectrum. So clearly the people who were willing to put $1 million ad buy were not getting the problems that those of us trying to put $10 ad buys were. So clearly money always has spoke at Facebook. There's an interesting politic going on, though. Facebook has been putting full-page ads in the paper saying, please regulate us. Some of them have been very clever ads. They're things like, you know, the last time internet regulation was passed, we heard about it by fax, right? Things like that. There was a full-page ad in the Times Union, I think a week ago Sunday, and a lot of New York Times online page has this neat little, you know, very humorous Zuckerberg video. And so I think part of this may be trying to play into that. You know, they were being accused of being unfair in what they were blocking. The right wing was yelling cancel culture, even though by and large, the evidence was that they were not hurting the right wing compared to anyone else. But then what's going on? So now Facebook says, okay, you know, now that it's not directly related to the presidential election, we move out, we make the money, and this starts pushing both sides to do that. You know, give us a regulation we can follow. So more seriously, the big issue they have is there is no rule. So they're making up their own rules about what advertisements to take. What advertisements won't they take? And every time they make that decision, they're facing a lawsuit.
Right.
Right. Or they're facing a change in the laws, which put in to restrict that could end up impacting all their other business.
So what would you do?
I think what they're really trying to do is get the people in the government who've been saying internet regulation needs to be revisited seriously to get together and start really doing that, because it gets a lot of airplay there. You know, there's a lot of lip service in Congress, but nobody seems to be really pushing very hard. They're using it to, you know, attack the company, but not to actually do anything.
In the statement, they said, we've heard a lot of feedback about this and learned more about political and electoral ads during this election, this past election cycle. As a result, we plan to use the coming months to take a closer look at how these ads work on our service to see where further changes may be merited. So wouldn't it make sense to do that without the ads instead of...
Well, that's what I would think.
Yeah.
You know, and I think there are some common sense things we could do as a country. So, for example, when you see a political ad on TV, it has to tell you who sponsored it. But when you see a political ad on Facebook, it doesn't. And you don't have any way to tell. So I have no idea whether this came from the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Russian, you know, disinformation party. And I think that's a real part of the problem and could be done with no free speech implications because, you know, we've already had that law for many years on TV and radio advertising. So, I mean, there are things that could be done that are pretty straightforward and simple, but they take, you know, both knowledge of what's really happening there and the will of the government to get involved in this kind of regulation. But it's going to happen sooner or later. It's very necessary.
I mean, part of the problem, too, is that we know what it causes, right? We know the disruption and the issues that the challenges and the problems that it causes when these ads are let out into the world.
Yeah, but at the same time, Joe, you know, being a good scientist and arguing both sides of the question, right? You do have the free speech issues.
Sure.
So the question becomes, what is a political ad? So, you know, let's take an earlier subject today. Supposing I wanted to advertise a QAnon thing. Is that a political ad? Well, no, except that we know that they have this close tie to the Republicans. So maybe it is, you know, that kind of thing. So, again, some of this, and then the other thing is, you know, when an ad goes in the paper or on TV, it's a small number of things that can be carefully done. The number of ads on Facebook are in the millions per hour, right? There's no way humans can look at every ad going on that thing. So that's the other thing. They're using a lot of technology, artificial intelligence, things like that. And I think part of it is just, you know, they're throwing up their hands a little bit and saying, you know, we can't detect the boundaries. Let's just, you know, try to let the things go out and see what happens. And then they're going to, you know, if they get a lot of pushback on this, then they'll come back with another thing. They're making up their own rules.
Teresa?
Well, I have more questions for Jim, not answers on this. But if Facebook is asking to be regulated, isn't that them just trying to offload their responsibility? And is it regulatable?
So,
for all the reasons you just said, because there's so many ads coming so quickly, how do you regulate it?
Well, that's the question. But again, there are things that could be done. I mean, for example, they know who has paid for every ad. Right. There are laws about, you know, what you do and don't reveal, but certainly they could, you know, be providing, you know, that information could be made much more transparent, both explicitly or, you know, other things. So, again, there's places where you could put fairly common sense regulations that would be easy for them to follow. But again, it requires understanding the platforms, knowing how things work. And of course, anything you put on Facebook is also going to hit a whole lot of other things. You can't just pass you could, but it wouldn't make any sense to pass a law that says Facebook cannot do X, but by the way, any other company can.
Right, it's got to be any platform.
It's got to be platform-based. And, you know, again, so these things aren't easy. Technology regulation never is, but it's not rocket science. It's political will.
But Jim, could Facebook today do what you just suggested, which says, okay, we're going to start ads again, but people are going to have to, the company's going to have to disclose in the ad who they are?
They could do that, or they could simply
say,
they could say, our policy is that if you have an ad that's deemed to be political, you must check this little box that says it's political, and we are allowed to put with your ad, you know, if someone clicks on your ad, we can show them who paid for it. And then, you know, if you put up an ad that was later judged to be political and you hadn't checked that box, you would get banned or thrown off or whatever. That would be, you know, a way that Facebook could do something very simple. The problem is if they don't have legal coverage for that, then they're just making up an arbitrary rule, and who's going to enforce it? Or if their competitors are letting you buy the ads without that, and they're making you put that on, you know, then won't they be at a disadvantage in the market? So, you know, there's this kind of give and take between making more money and doing what's right. And, you know, making more money has tended to win at Facebook.
But if they said any ad, you have to disclose who it is.
You know, unclear how that. I mean, you certainly could do that. It's just a question of again, would that put them at a disadvantage? You know, if all the companies would get together and say we're going to do that, I think it'd be great. But again, that's not happening at the moment. It's probably going to take regulation of some sort.
All right. Malcolm, anything on that?
No, brilliant discussion.
I thought so, too.
All right.
That's what I thought.
So thanks. Let's elevate it and talk about Dr. Seuss. So six Dr. Seuss books will no longer be published over offensive images. The company that oversees the children's author's estate said that the titles contain depictions of groups that were, quote, hurtful and wrong. So this is six books, and this has set off a frenzy and about cancel culture, and the right has gone ballistic over this. But I think it's important to point out that Dr. Seuss Enterprises, you know, the people who make the money by the sales of these books, have said that they will end publication and licensing of the books. This includes the most notable on this list, or and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which was written in 1937, and If I Ran a Zoo in 1950. McElligot's Pool is also included. And then there are three other books that, quite frankly, I don't know as well, On Beyond Zebra, Scrambled Egg Super, and The Cat's Quizzer. So who would like to
wait. You're the expert. You're the literature guy here. Yeah. You're the guy who interviews all of the authors. We expect you to tell us what's going on here.
Well, I think it's key. Look, I think any publisher decides what book can go in and out of print. The books aren't going away. They're in libraries. They're on eBay. They're in kids' collections all over the place. You know, we're not talking about burning them. We're saying is the people...
What's that? What's that noise?
I don't know what that is. But the people...
Sorry, that was Richard Engel.
Oh. Oh, what's he have to say about this?
He
says it's all BS.
Yeah. I just have to say that I think that, you know, if it's up to the family, it's up to the company that they no longer wish to publish these books, then that's certainly their right to do that.
Yeah, yeah. But what's the right? Joe, you're our expert. What's the right and wrong of it?
Well, the right of it is that those the correct of it is that these are hurtful images, and they're often put in libraries out of context and are there for kids to pick up and look at. And I understand that concern. You know, I think part of a larger, we're running out of time, but I think a part of a larger debate is, you know, where even Dr. Seuss stands in the canon of children's literature. I mean, there were really good books, obviously, but the more concerning thing to me is that the right has completely taken this as an example of cancel culture, and this on top of the degendering of Mr. and Mrs. Potato Head and so forth has become, you know, a major issue over the last several weeks. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a far more complex story. But as far as these particular books that I would say most kids didn't want to pick up in the first place because the rhyming wasn't really good, you know, the fact that they're no longer being published and a decision has been made by the company to pull them, well, that seems okay to me.
It would be great if you and Ray Graff could do a vox pop on this. It would be really.
Does anyone disagree with me or agree with? I don't know. What do you think?
I need to know more.
Fox News. Yeah. Fox News the other day did nonstop coverage of that story and did not play any of the testimony of the FBI director, the National Guard general, or any of the people in national security for a full 2 days.
Well, I understand.
They used it as a propaganda hammer.
Yeah, I understand your point, although I had the choice of reading the article about the hearing or Dr. Seuss, and I chose Dr. Seuss, too, so I don't know how bad that is. But,
Can't that, baby?
Yeah. You know,
there'll be people who don't like green eggs because they're vegetarian, you know. I mean,
yeah, the ham. Like, don't kill them, but don't add the ham. Yeah, that's right.
Because they're out of a pig.
All right. We'll end there. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. It is terrific to have you here. Alan, thank you very much. Teresa Bourgeois, Jim Henler, Malcolm Nance, you're the best. Thank you. We'll be back right after this.